Marathon mayhem, dodgy doping, social media shaming. The only thing hotter than this podcast right now is the temperature in the Qatari capital. Today, we pick apart the controversy at the IAAF World Championships. We delve into another, yes, another twist in Russian doping. And we've got our target set on the Twitter trolls and the Instagram idiots. Welcome, everyone, to Sportspiel. Yes, hello listeners, and welcome to your September discussion episode where we have assembled a panel full of journalistic expertise. First up, we have the man behind the think tank, Ollie Godden. Welcome to the podcast, Ollie.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
Next up, we also have an athlete and a journalist for the Sports Gazette. It's Julia Cook.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And let's not forget Sportspiel's resident arch-controversialist, the man who runs the 52 blog, is Will Moulton.
Thank you very much. I'm surprised when you said journalistic expertise, you didn't have a little dig at me there as well. Just saying journalistic expertise and Will.
And you, as the sole comms officer.
I wouldn't have minded.
But anyway, how is everyone, one and all, now that we've gathered collectively for the episode? Has it been a fun-filled week? There's been plenty of sport on, for instance.
Yeah, there's been a lot to see, obviously, with the athletics that we'll talk a lot about today, as well as the rugby and Japan's win today especially, which excited a few people. Yeah, it's been a fun-filled week, no doubt.
And so Japan win was particularly interesting this morning, wasn't it?
It was never in doubt. I think I turned on in the 35th minute, and from that point until the end of the game, Ireland won in the Japan 22. Japan were all over them. It was brilliant to watch. It reminded me of 2015. I was there watching at Twickenham. I was going to watch France-Italy, and we watched the South Africa-Japan game on a big screen, and we had 80,000 people cheering on Japan. It was insane, so it was nice to see them get another upset this morning.
Nice to always have a reminder of the point behind this podcast. We do have two debuts on the show, though. First up, then, Ollie, the man behind the think tank. Tell the listeners what the think tank is all about so they can get to know you a little bit better.
Yeah, so I sort of set up the think tank as an exploration into the journalistic world, I suppose. I've just started my master's in journalism, so it's something that I'm keen to get into. And I set up the think tank, I suppose, with a long-term venture of providing slightly controversial opinions and trying not to be too afraid of what other people might have to say. I must say I've started not too controversial. I don't want to upset too many fans if they're reading my article, so it's been a fairly subdued start, but that's the aim, is sort of try and get my teeth into a few topics and give my views on sporting world in general,
and to eventually upset a few people by the sounds of it.
It's not my intention. If I do it and I believe in something, then I'll write it, but we'll see how it goes.
I hope to see some of those all that analysis and those views come through later on. And Julia, how many sports have you actively participated in your life?
Probably too many to count, I think. Yeah, it's been a lot, definitely.
But also going down the journalistic route as well, because you've also just started your master's.
Yeah, just started my master's. I've been writing a few things for a couple of years now, but I wanted to get my journalism qualifications, get my master's, and yeah, definitely stay involved within sport, and I think it's a really great way to do it.
And ties me on brilliantly, because you've just joined the 52 blog.
I have, yes.
Thankfully, the person who runs that is next to me.
Yeah.
How are things going with that? Because there's been a lot of big change.
It's going very well. And as of today, when the podcast goes out, actually, no, yesterday, because we're going out on Monday, but Ollie is also going to be announced as our latest writer to the 52 as well.
You heard it here first, everyone.
So it's been exciting. I got to the end of the year and found that, you know, we've had 6,400 views to the website with no money, no financial backing. So I just thought, let's make this bigger and better. But what I did find was writing a weekly piece myself was quite a challenge. So I thought, let's have an expanded writing team. So I invited a couple of previous guests back to write more on a more regular basis, yourself included, alongside
didn't want to name names,
Remy Allen and Shona McCallan. Then I put the advert out there, and Julia and Ollie both got in contact, along with a couple of other people yet to be announced. Having read Julia's piece on Ailish McColgan that's due to go out in a couple of days, really exciting journalist in the making, having seen some of Ollie's stuff on the think tank, really exciting journalist in the making. So I'm very lucky to have got them involved, and I'm really excited to see where the 52 can go with our brand new pledge to make women's sport a platform to be seen, be heard and be inspired.
Very well done. So do go follow that on social media, because it's been plastered all over my timeline, for example. But anyway, today we have several items to get stuck into. First up, we're talking Doha and its suitability as hosts of the IAAF World Championships. Then we're turning to social media and body shamers, something that you, Julia, will have a particular interest in because of what has happened to Ailish McColgan recently, before we inevitably land at the front door of Russian doping, which we've done a few times on this podcast.
Have we?
Shock horror, yes. We'll get stuck into it after this. You're listening to Sportspiel, the Players Podcast. If you are an athletics fan, no doubt your eyes are currently glued to the IAAF World Championships in Doha. The championships run from September the 27th, that's yesterday as we record, through to Sunday, October the 6th. But just how suitable a venue is the capital of Qatar? In the words of The Telegraph's Ben Bloom, the championships descended into carnage in the early hours of Saturday morning during the women's marathon. The race was held at midnight to avoid the daytime heat, but it was still 30 degrees Celsius, with humidity never dropping below 80%. Just 40 of the 68 runners that started the race crossed the finish line, and a makeshift medical centre was set up next to it. Kenya's Ruth Chepnitich won the race in a time of 2 hours, 32 minutes and 43 seconds, and that is the slowest ever World Championships winning time. Focusing then on the scenes at the marathon and the weather conditions in Doha, is it the place to hold these championships?
I wanted to reserve judgment on the suitability, I suppose, of Doha until I'd seen or watched the event go live, because I'm not an athlete myself. So I thought, you know what, maybe these numbers that I'm seeing, they're suitable. Maybe the athletes, I'm sure Julia can attest to this or not, but maybe they are all right to run in. And then the calamity happened. And as you say, an extraordinary number of athletes dropping out. So I suppose the simple answer to your question is it's probably not. Whether the events inside the stadium are more suitable, obviously with the air conditioning, remains to be seen, I suppose, over a period of time. But for the marathon runners last night, it was a heavy run, I suppose.
I suppose as the athlete round the table, how much of an impact does weather conditions actually play? Because, I mean, we talked about the heat, but there's also the humidity to take into account here.
Yeah, they'll play a massive part, particularly within the longer events, the marathons, the walks outside of the stadium where there's no aircon, nothing. And Charlotte Perdue didn't finish. And what she did say afterwards is she's done so much preparation up to this. She's been training in heat chambers. She went out to Dubai as a holding camp to kind of prepare. And she still said nothing could prepare her for that. And unfortunately, as we know, she didn't finish. So yeah, it's all having a massive impact. And it seems like a lot of people couldn't have even prepared for it. Within the stadium, it seems to be better. You know, they've got the temperatures down to 25 degrees, I think, within the stadium with the air conditioning. So it will be better. But even the longer distances in there, I think they are struggling a bit. And we've seen that. And we saw that yesterday.
Well, we saw, as Julia says, we saw that yesterday, former guest Rosie Clark in the steeplechase, miles off her personal best, and the way she slumped to the ground after her heat was really worrying. And obviously we first and foremost hope she's okay, and it was such a shame because she's such a talented athlete, and she got through fairly far in 2017. And we also saw the scenes of the video that's trending on social media at the moment of the Aruban runner having to be helped over the line by the runner from Guinea-Bissau. And obviously Aruba isn't exactly a powerhouse of athletics, and they wouldn't have had the opportunity to maybe train as similar standards as sort of Charlotte Perdue, but no one should be left running like that in a race due to the heat. It's shocking to see, and it feels like if this is happening after day one, it feels like it could either go one of two ways. It could get better and we could, by the end of the tournament, be forgetting about this, or something incredibly serious could happen that will overshadow the entire thing.
do we worry that's where it's going to go then?
Having seen these scenes, I am terrified that that could happen.
I look at the 2016 UCI Road World Championships that were also held in Doha from September to October. What was that?
It's a spider on your headphones.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, they were moved from September to October because of the heat. And then we look at the 2022 FIFA World Cup, which is also supposed to be in Qatar, and that's getting its dates switched because of the heat. So why do we, or sports in general, keep going back to Doha and to Qatar if that is constantly proving to be a problem?
Do you want a controversial answer? Or
I mean, I might be leading on to something here, but...
There's a lot of money in Qatar and they want to host sporting events and they have bid the highest prices for them, and I'm not averse to that as such. What I don't understand with this particular event is why it hasn't been held later in the year when humidity drops a bit and temperatures drop a bit, because at the moment, I've been doing my research, temperatures will range between 26 to 27 degrees minimum, that's at night, to 40 degrees during the day with up to 80% humidity. You take that across to January, February, and those temperatures drop by about 10 degrees to about sort of 18 minimum and to about 30 maximum. Similar humidity, but why have we not waited a few more months to host the championships? I know it's supposed to be every 2 years, but for the sake of athlete health, I think Julia's going to come in with a point here. For the sake of athlete health, I feel like you probably should have waited a little bit.
Yeah, so it's definitely all to do with scheduling. The World Indoors will be at that time, basically, will be February, March kind of time. And so it's already such a late season for our athletes and people are already really struggling. And people are going to have to peak, if they want to do the World Outdoors, the World Indoors and the Olympics, going to have to peak three times in a year, which is already kind of a big ask for some people. So yeah, that's kind of why, just so it doesn't clash with the World Indoors. And then that would also mean it was so close to the Olympics as well. And it will be really difficult for people to be in shape for all of that.
Doesn't that bring up more questions then as well? If you already knew that the scheduling was going to be a problem, why don't you then make sure you have a location and a host city that is usable at that time of year for athletes?
Yeah, it definitely does, and it has been an issue being a late season, and some people have even decided not to go to Worlds because it is so late. So yeah, it's definitely a scheduling issue massively.
I think it does, to a point, as you said earlier, reflect commercial sport in the current climate, in that obviously the Football World Cup is going to be there. There's been cycling there. We're not potentially at a stage where the athletes' health and their peaking is a priority for the organisers themselves. So to what extent that needs to be transferred and a more of a serious consideration of athlete health is a high priority is definitely a consideration, because it should be emphasized. It's not suitable for quick running time. It's not like it's sad because it's slow. It's genuinely dangerous, and that's what we've seen with athletes going off in wheelchairs and off in stretchers during the marathon. It's sort of sad to see in a way, but it is reflecting of commercial sport in this day and age, I suppose.
This is a question we've asked a fair few times for a number of different topics. Do we forget that athletes are human?
Yes, yeah. And I think France's Johan Dinis summed that up perfectly, actually. I was just about to make this point, but so he's the world 50-kilometre walk champion, and he came out and said, "I am extremely upset. If we were in this stadium, we would have normal conditions, but outside, they have placed us in a furnace, which is just not possible. They are making us guinea pigs." That's strong.
You wonder how many athletes it would take to say that kind of thing for organisers to sort of, for their ears to prick and think, right, what does need to change then? Because obviously it's a nice soundbite for someone to be saying that, especially a reigning champion of prestige, but how many people need to say that for organisers to think, right, yeah, change needs to happen at this point?
His national compatriot, Kevin Maher, the decathlete, who is one of the sport's biggest stars, has also called the event a disaster, and he hasn't even started competing yet.
We're only on day two.
Exactly.
He's going to be freshly air-conditioned as well, so...
Well, begs all sorts of questions. I suppose another theme then to take away from the championships at the moment is the attendances. And we can talk about athlete welfare, but I suppose a lot of people's priorities is obviously getting big numbers in terms of attendances into that stadium, but it hardly looks good at the moment. Back on the 23rd of September, Sean Ingle of The Guardian reported that migrant workers and children will be bussed in by organisers to fill seats because of poor ticket sales. They're already as well blanking off the top section of the stadium in Kartal. And I remember for the UCI Rower World Championships 3 years ago, we were both training at the time and we did sort of practice live reports on that. There was no one there. No one was watching that championships whatsoever. An IAAF spokesperson said ticket sales had been challenging, but that nobody could have foreseen the boycott of Qatar by Gulf states. Again, this begs the question, location-wise, if the attendances aren't there, then what's the point? Because as a large part of this, or a large part of the point of going to places like Qatar, is finding new audiences. So why haven't we got an audience?
People in the Middle East don't really care about these sports. So cricket for me is a prime example. Pakistan have not been able to play at home for 10 years. So they've moved to Dubai and Abu Dhabi and across the United Arab Emirates. No one goes and watches because no one really cares. And I think we're seeing the same issue here with athletics, is that there is absolutely no fan base in Qatar for athletics. They might get decent crowds at the Football World Cup because football is more of a universal sport. But how many Qatari athletes can you sort of recall off the top of your head? The only one I could think of is the high jumper whose name escapes me. Other than that, I cannot think of a single one. So why would they turn out and watch? Because there's nothing of interest for them there.
I also think the location as well. There's obviously so many athletics fans within Europe and within the US and all over the world, but those spaces mainly. And these fans aren't necessarily thinking, oh, I really want to go to Doha. It's not an easy place to get to. It's not necessarily an attractive place for them to want to go to. So I think that's an issue as well. Like when we saw it in London, ticket sales were international. And at home as well, we've got so many fans. So I think the fans aren't thinking that this is somewhere where we want to go. So that's something to consider.
Does it reinforce the way that sport as well is intertwined with the political aspect as well? Because we see it time and time again how a big sporting event can be used to, I don't want to say influence, but at least boost, say, societal morale in the country. And considering the challenges that Qatar faces, is that something that we're perhaps seeing as well? I love a big question.
That is a very big question. I think you're right in saying that there is an opportunity in it being staged in Qatar for political arguments to surface. That's obviously wrong, and we've seen it, well, through decades, really, I suppose, in the Olympics, when you think back to the boycotts of Moscow and LA. Again, I suppose we're harking back to the same thing every time. What is it going to take for organisers to stop looking at the money and think of the repercussions of holding it in these locations, I suppose, to an extent?
Speaking of money, and this is something we touched upon before we pressed the record button, this was reported yesterday by Sean Ingle again, yesterday being Friday. French judges are currently investigating whether $4.5 million was paid by the organisers in Qatar to the former IAAF marketing executive Papa Massata Diak, remember him, hours before Doha were given the right to host the event. This proposal has never been publicly revealed, but has been seen by The Guardian, the French media outlet Mediapart, and Der Spiegel in Germany. It would have led the organisers buying the right to keep revenues from ticket sales and from national sponsors in Qatar in exchange for a series of payments to Sporting Age, an offshore company in Singapore with links to Diak. For the record, Diak and his father, Lamine Diak, who is the former IAAF president, are due to stand trial on corruption charges next year in Paris. Both men deny the charges. But again, from a sports fan point of view, this just clouds it all in controversy, and it's ultimately depressing again, isn't it?
I love athletics. I've always loved watching athletics. And it's horrible to look at the sport and just think what could be going on behind the scenes, because you want to watch it for incredible feats of athletic talent. The stuff that these athletes do is insane. But you've always got nagging in the back of your mind now, corruption and doping. And it's annoying. I don't like it, and I want it to go away.
In terms of conclusions then, can we, first and foremost, find any positives from the athletics championships?
So one thing on the crowd side, I think it's early days. Yesterday, there weren't any finals, obviously, apart from the marathon. So we might see some crowds start picking up as we get the finals today, 100-meter final men's. Hopefully that will start to pick up. So yeah, we might start to see something pick up, hopefully.
And I suppose final question, will we then keep seeing events going out to Doha? Will things maybe improve in the future as well?
It's not the first event that's been held in Doha. The 2015 Para Athletics Worlds were held out there, but I think it depends on how this tournament goes. If the on-field action takes over, especially for us Brits, there's quite a good chance of a serious medal haul. Dina Asher-Smith, Katarina Johnson-Thompson, Holly Bradshaw are names that just spring to mind. If the on-field action is positive and takes over and we see some incredible stuff, then we might forget about the rest of it. But if something serious happens, like I'm fearful of, then this could be the last athletics event we see held in a location like this for a while.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. Or to follow up on that point, I think there'll be serious concerns raised, if they haven't already, about the holding of the Football World Cup there. If there is to be a serious incident, I think there will be questions asked about the genuine suitability. I know it's at a different time of the year, but there's still going to be safety concerns definitely leading up to that. So I suppose we'll have to wait and see.
Social media, an environment where you can experience the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. Ahead of the IAAF World Championships, British long distance runner Ailish McColgan hit out at the sexist, body-shaming trolls that like to lurk on the internet. This week, the 28-year-old gave an interview to The Eye about her reaction on Twitter. On that moment, she called out the said trolls, writing, or rather she shared a screenshot of the comments and wrote, "Nothing pisses me off more than someone making a comment that I'm too skinny. I'm naturally small, always have been. Some people are just slim." And she then went on to say, "Go body shame elsewhere." It's not a new thing. Our former guest, Leah Lyons, as well, is someone who's also been the victim of body shaming on social media as well. So how do you start then to take control over online abuse?
So there was a guy published this week and about trolls and about them targeting celebrities to kind of widen their exposure. And one thing they did say, I do really respect McColgan for speaking out and for speaking up about it, but one thing this report said is that these people are using celebrities to widen their own exposure, and they're using that platform, and by responding you're actually giving them a bigger platform. So it's something that we need to be really careful when we're interacting with trolls, is to not kind of boost their platform and kind of help them, because yeah, they might not have affected you, but they could then go on to affect someone else. So
is it that piggybacking, I suppose, off of someone else's account?
I suppose the opposite side of the argument to that is it takes a very strong-willed person to be hurled abuse at and just to and ignore it. I suppose if you're in the street and someone abuse you, it'd, you know, take some courage just to bypass it and try and ignore it. So I can see why athletes do respond to the bait and do try and get do get sort of dragged into arguments, and it is something that we have to have sympathy with, because it's such a hard one to deal with from an athlete's perspective.
I suppose as well, if you do call someone out, like I said, you gather a great amount of respect for yourself as well. But then it's a debate we can have. Is it, what kind of side of the fence are we sitting on? Is it trying to do your best to just ignore it at all costs, or call it out for what it's worth? Because we talk about the sexism side of things, the body shaming side of things, but we've also got the racism side of things that is creeping into, I say creeping in, it's been around for a while, but we've talked about it a lot over the last few weeks. We see that creeping in as well. Is it important to have these discussions?
Absolutely, and I didn't think I'd ever find myself saying this as a Liverpool fan, but the respect I have for the way Raheem Sterling is dealing with things at the moment, you don't see him replying to specific comments that often, if at all. But he comes out and he makes powerful statements in the media, and he's letting his football doing the talking. And I think there was that campaign set up and announced a couple of weeks ago, which was fronted by the likes of Gary Lineker and Rachel Riley, about not responding to the trolls. And I think that actually that's quite a good thing, because calling people out, it's what they want you to do. They want people to see them, and they want like-minded people to follow them, etc., etc., and that sort of snowball effect. Calling people out as a whole on bigger platforms during media interviews and doing stuff like that is fine, and I think that should be encouraged. But I think individually calling out trolls there's going to be so many of them, it's going to be difficult to reply to all of them, and it's not worth it.
Well, the four of us, we're all involved in one way or another in the journalism industry, which itself is a target for trolls and online abuse. I don't know if anyone has specific experiences that they want to share of stuff that they've had happen to them.
Personally, for me, hiding behind the accounts of a national governing body, I don't specifically get called out as in my name, but we do get enough stick to notice as a governing body, and sometimes that's with the athletes, and sometimes that's with the way the sport is run, and sometimes that is with the way I phrase things on social media. And our policy is just to not respond, and it can be quite difficult, because when you find a forum that people are writing on that are laughing and joking about you, and you want to respond saying, well, if I said what I was really thinking, if I was being brutally honest on our GB channels, I would be sacked. It's just about having that self-restraint not to reply. But because we don't get as much, it's okay. And I speak to someone about it, and it's easy to let it go. But I can imagine if you're an athlete or if you're a sport, football must be horrible for comms officers sporting. So for example, Watford at the moment, I can imagine that's a pretty nasty job to have. Social media is just horrible at times.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. It's obviously interesting being doing my journalism studies now to an extent, because there is no textbook on how to deal with it. You're getting lectures, you're getting told that it's a very real possibility, and in fact, we see it ourselves, in fact, on social media. But there is no set way of going, right, this is the way that you've got to respond to it. So you've got to be really fluid in terms of what is best for what situation, but it's something that's a very real possibility in terms of trolling, and something we have to respond to. I'm sure you have experience yourself, Alistair, of a bit of online trolling, or so be it, with the local press.
Yes, local press. I think I've told the story before on this podcast about that time I was threatened with being stabbed by someone whose mate I reported on in court. But in terms of policy, what my publisher has tried to do is categorise levels of abuse, from, you know, minor abuse up to the very worst you can possibly have, obviously death threats and things like that at the top. And I suppose the stance we've kind of taken is that if it's relatively minor, it's okay to have a bit of fun with it and respond with it. Like that time I think someone called me a nerd on social media, which is fine, I'll happily take that and respond to it. But then it goes up to the being threatened with violence, and that at that point, so once we've gone beyond the minor abuse, that's when we stop responding, and that's the policy we've taken as a publisher. So I suppose when we try and bracket all this abuse into one category, it's not actually that easy. Do we need to take a more of a commonsensical view to the different levels of abuse, I suppose? Because obviously if it gets too violent, that's probably when we should take a stand and not actually call it out and just leave it be, if that's fair to say.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I think there is something to be said, and kind of building on your points there, is that individually calling out people, I don't think that's the way to go. But if it sparks a debate about these issues, then that's definitely a good thing to do. But yeah, not increasing individuals' platforms is definitely a good thing. But if we can start talking about these issues, then something good is coming from it, and then that is a good thing.
I suppose I kind of bring that in as well, based on what Phil Neville said probably about a month ago now, where he was calling on people and players to boycott social media in its entirety. Is that counterproductive, or would that actually set a precedent and quite a strong message, particularly to social media companies?
To an extent, but you've got to remember the people behind the trolling aren't particularly bothered, I don't think, by the action taken by certain corporations or NGBs or individual players. If that's the case, if they boycott, they'll probably find someone else to go and troll from behind a screen, until a point I suppose there's no one on social media anymore, but I'm sure they'll find someone to troll if it's not the person they've done to previously.
It would be a shame for the nice fans, the genuine sports fans, because people love getting to know and interact with athletes in a way that they wouldn't be able to do otherwise.
Yeah, it's partly the point of this show, so
a way that social media wouldn't. The way social media only encourages, for example, asking an Instagram question and getting your fans' opinions and things like that, which is nice for the athletes and is nice for the supporters. So it would be a shame to take that away, but there's got to be a way of, for example, on YouTube,
on certain videos you can disable comments. Is there a way we can do that on Instagram? Is there a way we can do that on Twitter? Having some sort of filtering system that isn't necessarily reliant upon the social media companies to put in place, but the user can do it themselves. It just seems to be that there needs to be an easier way of getting rid of the trolls that doesn't place the entire emphasis just on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram.
A lot of people mention the education side of things as well. Do we maybe put too much emphasis on educating people? Maybe if you are one of these people who is behind an account such as that, are you beyond education? If that but they, is worthy, but a what, worthy
what,
question.
I'm gonna throw in a philosophical question here. What is education? Because you may be educated on the argument you're talking about, but not necessarily on all the other arguments.
You've been reading some like philosophical
no,
books or something.
That thought just popped into my head, which is worrying. I might need to lie down in a minute.
I also think it's probably a manifestation of their own ignorance in a way. I think new stuff will. I think you can probably educate about one particular trolling incident. Definitely explain why their comment is wrong, but they'll still find a new way to say something that is quite ignorant and derogatory. And whether we can educate about the whole area is definitely difficult to do. But I think Will mentioned a very good point. I think social media, the benefits far outweigh the drawbacks and the negatives. So it is just finding a way. It's very easy for us to sit here and say, go on, find a way of controlling it. But if we can find a way to stem the flow of trolling, then far more good can come of it.
Another big question, I suppose, is as a society, maybe, do we need to grow thicker skin? Go on.
Most people do have fairly thick skin, and a lot of people can take abuse that's thrown at them, but some of the abuse that people are coming out with is horrendous. Racism, sexism, like body shaming is horrible, and certain people are more body conscious than other people. Certain people may be able to brush those comments off. Some people might not be able to be it, but I don't think we're that thin-skinned. I think it's people are just horrible more than anything.
Yeah, I think that's probably a little bit harsh to say. Grow a bit of a thicker skin. It just all feels a bit... these comments are a bit unnecessary, I guess, and there's just no real reason for them. So I don't think that's our biggest issue here.
I've got to play the devil's advocate question every so often.
So before we get to the conclusion, I have a question for Julia, sort of going back to the issue that we initially raised with Ailish Colgan. And one reason that track and field athletes are so open to body shaming is through the little amount of clothing that you wear. And I was just thinking, from sort of your perspective, is that something you particularly think about, or is it just something that you're given this and you're more focused on actually going and competing to your best abilities?
Yeah, I definitely think it's just you just get on with it. There are kind of different options to people who don't want to necessarily, for girls it's usually the crop top and the pants, and if you don't want to wear that, then you can wear a vest, you can wear shorts, you can wear whatever. But I think if we're focusing on that as the root of the issue, then what we're saying is we're telling people to go and body shame people in other sports instead of us. So I think if we, for example, change what we wore, people would just go and find other people to body shame. So I don't think that's the root of the issue at all. I think the root of the issue is the people that are doing it, and that's what we need to be thinking about. So I think there's definitely other options for people, but it's not the biggest issue. The clothes aren't the issue, really.
And another interesting topic as well is, I've heard a few comments recently about how glamorized so many track and field athletes are about the hair and the makeup and everything. And the BBC did that video the other day with, was it Queen Clay and Shawnee Milowebo and Alicia Newman, and about how they use the hair and their makeup as war paint and stuff like that, I guess. That's another interesting topic, and actually I think the BBC did quite a good thing from my perspective in, you know, highlighting that. But is that very much an individual athlete preference?
Yeah, I think it's definitely individual. Some people really find that it helps their performance. I definitely find if I feel like I look good, then I definitely perform better and I just feel that confidence. And for me, that's important. And I think other people do find that as well. And so it can help some people, definitely. And also some people find that it helps them becoming more marketable, so that it helps them get the sponsorships and things like that, so it can be really important. Like Jess Ennis had some, I want to say it was L'Oreal she was sponsored by, someone like that, and there are athletes, it's becoming more and more common for people to get these sponsorships that aren't necessarily sport, but also other commercial sponsorships. And with the track and field, the money isn't great, so that can really help them, so I think it's definitely important.
I suppose then, drawing together some conclusions, and we've obviously touched on the body shaming thing as a as a specific case study, then do we kind of need to focus on stuff away from social media as well? Because we talk about, say, insecurities and anxieties that people have, whether it's mental health awareness as well. And we've often talked about the lack of, say, mental health support for a lot of people out there. Is maybe that an avenue we should be talking about, in that building up people's own self-confidence in themselves and trying to help treat those aspects is maybe a better way of dealing with online abuse, because in one way or another, it's always going to be there.
I think maybe we talked about education. It's maybe educating people on what upsets individuals and what upsets them, what makes them feel insecure, and helping them overcome that rather than dealing with the ignorant people, because everybody has their own insecurities, everyone has their own things that they'll get worked up about. And it's a case of, I think, educating people to accept that this might affect you in a different way, that it will affect someone else, and actually being able to cope with that. So, for example, for me, I'm actually, it might not seem it, but I'm very body conscious. The last 3-4 years, I've developed a lot of body consciousness. Someone makes a comment about me, like my mum makes a joke or something, I automatically hit the roof, because I'm not happy with those sorts of comments. So for me, it's about, I know that I have this thing, and it's about, for me, about working a way through it. And not everyone is going to know what affects them. Sometimes you have to have some help to find that out. But I think it is about educating the person on how to deal with their issues and overcome those issues. I think that's going to be more effective than educating the ignorant assholes.
Yeah, I would agree with that for sure. And you mentioned there about mental health outlets. And if people have someone to talk to about this, and that's only going to help them, and it's only going to make things better for them. So I definitely think it's an important issue, and it does go hand in hand for sure.
Hello, listeners. Enjoying the podcast? Well, you can find even more of the same on our website, sportspielonline.com. That's our home for everything, and you can find features, opinion pieces, and maybe even the odd blog. So if you love sport, make sure you check it out. That's sportspielonline.com. In our final part, it is time to turn to the ever-uplifting topic of doping. On September the 21st, it was reported that some Russian drug testing laboratory data may have been manipulated before it was retrieved by WADA. With less than a year until the 2020 Olympics, doping compliance proceedings have now been opened against the Russian Anti-Doping Agency relating to inconsistencies in the data retrieved by WADA in January 2019 from the Moscow lab at the centre of the McLaren report. RISADA were reinstated as compliant back in September 2018, so a year now, but that was on a number of conditions, including handing over all of that data from the Moscow lab. It's another twist in this never-ending saga. But is it actually a surprise that we're talking about more negativity again on this story?
No.
Insightful, thank you.
I mean, when we all saw this story came out, our reaction was, yeah, fair enough. Like, we could see that coming, because Russia have been a thorn in the side of UCAD and WADA and pretty much every anti-doping agency for ages. So to find out that they may have manipulated data after everything else they've done, it's not in any way a surprise for me.
In terms of sanctions, do we predict something similar? If they are obviously found to have manipulated this data, but something similar to what we saw in 2018 at the Winter Olympics, i.e. where they competed as neutral athletes or Olympic athletes from Russia, or are we going to go a step further this time?
I think we'll definitely start with something similar, and I think it's definitely a step we need to be taken, but we do need to look at steps further for sure. And there's a lot of talk about overhauling WADA, for example, and kind of hoping to see whether there could be some really big changes. But yeah, I think with this case, it's been going on for so long now, and we're not really getting anywhere. And so many different things have happened that are so bad that we do definitely, I think, need to go a step further and see what we can do.
I think it's something that we mentioned earlier in terms of the lay fan, if you like. The cloud over athletics is largely due to doping, and until we sort of stamp out that the culture of doping, I don't want to call it that because maybe it's not that that common. But until we can ensure by one way or another that doping is not in place in athletics, and there's still going to be that cloud over the whole event. I don't know if that's a bit harsh maybe on new athletes, but especially maybe for yourself as an athlete that's coming through and hoping to compete. I don't know what your opinion is on the fact that the lay fan has that perception of athletics.
I mean, I'm an athlete and I still kind of have that perspective on it, in that it is a massive issue in our sport and it's something that we do really need to fix. And the stuff that's come out recently, you really want to believe that they're not doping. You really want to believe that Coleman and there's also the 17-year-old Brianna Williams, you really want to believe they're not doping. But at the same time, I totally believe that it could be possible that they are. And that's kind of where our sport is at. And I think that's so bad that we've got to this point. And there's always been clouds of suspicion around so many athletes. And the thing is, the dopers are always one step ahead. And that's something we've always seen. And we saw it with Russia. And we're finally catching up to Russia. But at the same time, I don't think we are catching up to Russia. And they still do seem to be one step ahead. So it's what we can do.
It's the step ahead kind of things. And we talk about sanctions against, say, the governing body or Russia as a country. But when we look at the actual penalties for doping, again, we bring in your experiences as an athlete. Do they in themselves need looking at?
Yes, I think they probably do. The fact that there are some athletes who have had doping bans and they're coming back to compete, you know, they've still been able to train under these drugs. They've still had competitions they might have not been caught in. And so I think sanctions, I'm all for them being harsh and very harsh and lifetime bans and things. So, yeah, I think we do need to look individually at sanctions as well.
It's worth pointing out that it's not just Russia under suspicion at the moment. Of course, they've got this massive ongoing case, but there are other nations as well. Kenya and Jamaica, two countries, and then individual athletes from a number of other countries. So doping isn't just Russian, it's a sport-wide, it's a global thing. But it's also worth pointing out that in this country, I think there are only around 12 track and field athletes serving doping bans. Compare that to rugby union and rugby league, where combined they've got more than 100. Cycling is up there as well. And so I think it's less of an issue in this country. I don't think we should be looking at our British athletes and scrutinising them as much as we do athletes from other countries. But it, as I said earlier, it's just a shame that we have corruption and doping hanging over a sport that I've loved watching for eternity, and so many people do, because it's brilliant.
But then we mentioned that cloud over athletics, and you mentioned the rugby side of things there. Is it unfair to put that cloud on athletics from a news agenda standpoint?
I think it is probably a little bit harsh, but the media absolutely love it when an athlete is caught doping, and they really do go hard on it within athletics. And yeah, as you say, it's not really picked up on within rugby and football as much, but they really seem to love it within athletics. And I think it is kind of because we do have this reputation and people do take it so seriously. So yeah, it's maybe a little bit unfair on athletics.
But then that must really damage the product, essentially, that you're selling to a spectator. So how do you actually take the steps to bring that back or repair that damaged bond? Obviously it will take time, and probably the sanctions and investigations have a lot to say in that, but is there any way you can bridge that gap between the sport, the product, and the fan now, if there is so much negativity around it?
I think you have to, from a British perspective, keep promoting the fantastic athletes we've got, because at the moment, as a nation, we are blessed with not just some incredibly talented athletes, but they also come across as really, really good people. Dina Asher-Smith, Katarina Johnson-Thompson, Greg Rutherford when he was competing, Jess Ennis-Hill when she was competing. So many good people, and I think British athletics are doing a very good job of putting them and their personalities in our faces. And I would want to go and watch them, because I feel like they're good people and I feel like they're incredible athletes who we could see win medals. So from a British perspective, I think the cloud is sort of, we're not as worried about our own athletes. It's just a case of, can all the nations do that and help bust that myth?
And I suppose one last body to ask questions about is the World Anti-Doping Agency, because a lot of people have asked about how much influence, how much powerful, are they actually a productive organisation considering what they're supposed to do? Do we also need to look at WADA here and maybe reform how they go about their business, or look at the way they can dish out penalties and sanctions and here and there?
I think yes, I suppose it's probably the short answer to your questions. I think scrutiny also needs to be held to national anti-doping agencies themselves. There is an expectation from WADA that the national anti-doping agencies want to be compliant. So that's to say that UCAD want to promote clean athletics. Obviously, we're in a state where financially with athletics, we've got reasonable backing. If you look at other nations, maybe in Africa, where their financial backing for the athletes isn't so strong and needing to win medals to compete further down the line, then there is going to be less of a willingness to be compliant by those anti-doping agencies. It's a horrible thing to say, and it's very pessimistic, I suppose, but it is something that needs to be considered if we're looking at the organisations that are in play.
So, final question, from a fan's point of view, when Tokyo comes around, are we all going to be worried that this is going to be hanging over it much the same way that it did in Rio, much the same way that it did in Pyeongchang as well?
If the anti-doping bodies, WADA, USADA for the Americans, UCADs and all that, get their acts together and are making decisions and are not contradicting each other, which they have done in the Christian Coleman case, with WADA finding inaccuracies and USADA's findings, that's been a complete nightmare. If they can get their acts together and be a bit stricter and just make sure everything is in order, then the buzz of the Olympic Games, as it does every 4 years, that will take over, and we will remember those games for the feats of sporting brilliance, because there won't be any issues with doping in terms of cock-ups at the games. Obviously, after the games, we'll probably find a few, but as long as they get them, everyone gets themselves in order and just everything is smooth running between now and the Olympics, and Russia, a decision is made on Russia sooner rather than later, we can enjoy Tokyo Olympics and Paralympics for what they will be, which is an incredible 2 weeks of sport.
Said by a true comms officer. Some final messages after this very short pause. Right, that is almost it for our September discussion episode. Again, big thank yous to Ollie and Julia for coming on and providing the valuable analysis that we promised everyone at the start. What is everyone doing in the next week or so, sporting-wise? I know we're going to West Ham and Spurs tomorrow at the Olympic Stadium.
We are. And then next week, the Great Britain women's hockey team have 3 test matches against India, building up to the Olympic qualifiers next month, which is a nerve-wracking time. You can already feel the tension in the office because a lot is riding on this. I mean, the teams will be fine. I have no doubt that they will qualify for the games. But yeah, just it's a tense time at GB hockey at the moment, which is quite interesting.
Should be exciting though. Anyone else got anything other than studies and shorthand practice, of course?
Yeah, lots of shorthand for sure. Definitely just watching the athletics. Hopefully nothing goes wrong. And yeah, hopefully enjoying some really good performances, which I think we will definitely see. And yeah, I look forward to it a lot.
No, yeah, similarly, I'll be tuning into athletics. Hopefully we can bring some medals home. And as Will said earlier, that can alleviate the woes that we have about potential doping scandals. But other than that, I'm sure I'll be glued to the situation at Stoke City as I adopt them as a new home club and what's going on there.
Things are not going well at the moment.
Nope. Bring back Pulis.
Bring back Pulis. As well, I wanted to ask one question, or this question to all of you, because today is obviously Monday. The September the 30th, we're definitely not recording this on Saturday. It's International Podcast Day, everyone. So other than this podcast, obviously, what favourite podcast do you like listening to? What suggestions have we got for the listeners?
I only listen to our podcast.
Really?
Yeah.
Disappointing.
There's definitely been a resurgence of the podcast, I'd say, in the last couple of years, which is, I suppose, a bit backwards in the way with the advance of media and social media. Tail Enders is a definite one that I'd tune into without fail. As a big cricket fan, it provides me with the laughs I need to get me through the week.
The Peter Crouch podcast, that's a good podcast for anyone who's into their football. Yeah, really good, really funny. Outside of Sport, Guilty Feminist, if anyone's up for that, that's a really good podcast as well, nice and funny. So yeah, those two are definitely my favourites.
Good recommendations. I'm also going on Monday night to the Totally Football Show live at the South Bank Centre. So that's going to be good.
Aren't we also being featured as part of a
that's what I was also going to say.
Podcast special as well?
So on International Podcast Day, the documentary One Voice, One Mic, is being released. And we're in it.
Apparently.
We're in it, apparently, on the trailer. So it's us and Shona McCallan, that episode. So in terms of how we're related or feature, I have no idea yet. So everyone watch that documentary. I'm sure it'll be great.
Oh, watch it. Oh, I thought it was going to be a podcast.
Oh, no, it's on YouTube.
Oh, right.
You can watch it, Will.
Whoops.
We're going to be live, our faces and everything. In terms of our own podcast, we are back on Sunday, October 13th, with another feature interview, which also comes in handily with the podcast chat because it's the host of the Athlete's Voice podcast, who happens to be Yona Knight Wisdom, Jamaica's only diver. He's from Leeds, Leeds-born, currently lives in Edinburgh, and for the Liverpool fans amongst us, he is Andre Wisdom's cousin. So there you go. But yeah, a lot of interesting chat on that one, so everyone stay tuned for the next podcast on October the 13th. Other than that, do follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, YouTube as well. All of our handles are SportsBuildPod. And of course, do send us any messages or emails that you have. Our email address is sportsbuildpod@gmail.com. That is it for this episode. Thank you to Julia.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you to Ollie.
Thank you very much.
You're always here, but thank you.
Love you.
And we'll see you next time.